Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. Well, I'm sure that in this country, there are a lot of people who think about horse racing, pay attention to horse racing, really only once a year. They watch one race, and that's the Kentucky Derby. Now, that certainly is an important race, and in fact, the Derby and the course, Churchill Downs, may well be at the pinnacle of the racing world, but that really doesn't represent, at least not entirely, the racing world. We'll be talking about what things are like maybe kind of on the other end of the spectrum as we talk with T.D. Thornton about his recent book, Not By a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. It profiles 1 year of activity at the racetrack Suffolk Downs. Suffolk Downs is a track that goes back quite a way. It opened up in 1935, and at that time, it was one of the finest horse tracks of the day. But, say, by the mid-1990s, it was very clear that the glory time was long over there at Suffolk Downs. T.D. Thornton says that the racing was lousy, the profits and the morale were down, and there were a lot of people who just quit, and they just left. However, other people stayed. And in the book, he makes the argument that perhaps it's these really hardcore players who are, among other things, the unseen supporting cast for the nation's betting industry. His book, Not By a Long Shot, tells the story of life in the minor leagues of the sport of kings. And he's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him. He's written for several newspapers, most notably the Boston Globe and the National Thoroughbred Daily Racing Times. His work has also appeared in a number of literary journals. He often comments on racing on television and radio. He makes his home outside of Boston, and he's joining us by phone. The book, by the way, is published by Public Affairs. It's out now in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Mr. Thornton, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you
today? I'm fine. Thanks, and you?
I'm excellent. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I appreciate you giving us your time. So just here, we need to define a term here that you mentioned in the book. What is a racing degenerate?
A racing degenerate would be me. it's a term of endearment, even though it sounds a little gruff and a little rough around the edges and not very complimentary. It's what racetrackers might call themselves if they're fully ingrained in the game. I'm the type of guy, for example, using me as an example as a racetrack degenerate. I won't go to family functions or weddings on Saturdays because they usually coincide with the sports big races. I spend way too long late at night with my head buried in racing statistics and not really doing it so much for the money or the glitz or the glamour, doing it because I love it. And degenerates are the type of guys. I work with a bunch of guys here at the track at Suffolk Downs in Boston, and there are racetracks all across the country filled with degenerates, and they're guys and women who would gladly work and toil at the racetrack for 6 days a week, and if you get one day off, you simply go and visit another racetrack.
Self-confessed racing degenerate. You say in the book that you started going to the track when you were in your teens. Is that right?
It was even a little bit before that. I started going to the track by myself when I was old enough to get a driver's license. I grew up in a racetrack town in New Hampshire, a little track called Rockingham Park in Salem, New Hampshire. And my parents were school teachers. My dad also, by night, was an NCAA basketball referee, and because he's one of those guys that always has to be doing something, he filled up his time in between with a small stable of racehorses, just one or two horses, kind of a mom-and-pop operation. And from a young age, some of my earliest memories are at the racetrack, and I can very specifically remember being about age five and my dad going over to the paddock where you would saddle the horse to get ready for a race. And, of course, kids, at least at that age, four or five, aren't allowed in the paddock because you're going to get stepped on or kicked by a thoroughbred racehorse. But I knew somehow that I wanted to be on the other side of that fence where all the action was. And if I could ever scheme or dream a way to get over there, that's what I was going to do with my life.
Yeah. Horse racing certainly has declined in popularity as a result, I think, in large part, as a result of the competition from other forms of gambling or the availability of other forms of gambling. States have lotteries. There are a lot of casinos now. So there are other, if you want to place a bet, there are other ways that you can do that. But at the same time, I think that it's true that there are a lot of people that continue to, there's something very seductive about it. I'm not exactly sure what it is. You can answer that question, but there seem to be a lot of people who still are drawn to the track, to the horses. What is it, you think, that is so attractive?
Well, I couldn't really put my finger on giving you that answer in your one-hour radio show here, nor could I hopefully I sufficiently explained it in 370 pages and not by a long shot, but it's one of those elusive qualities that's kind of hard to define. People certainly aren't going out to the races, at least the people who toil anonymously on the back stretches of minor league tracks all across the country. They're really not doing it for money. They're doing it, I would say, to a large degree because of a raw, visceral love of the horse. Some people come to the track for a day at the races, and they never leave, so to speak. They do it because the racetrack, if it's got one really redeeming quality, is that hope is everywhere. You might have a stable full of cheap horses that can't run worth a lick. You're up to your neck in vet bills. You can't pay the help that well. You're grinding along. I know some people at small tracks like Suffolk Downs who live on site in subsidized dormitories, which are really little more than tack rooms that lack a lot of basic amenities. And they keep plugging along day after day, year after year, grinding it out for the hope that one day they will latch onto that one great horse. And there are a lot of rags-to-riches stories in horse racing. Take, for example, to bring up something that's fresh on a lot of people's minds, Calvin Burrell, the jockey who just won the Kentucky Derby on the first Saturday in May at Churchill Downs, the biggest race in all of horse racing. And Calvin was a guy who his dad raised sugar cane. He grew up in a very poor family down in the south part of Louisiana. His brother was in the horse business, and his dad let him quit school in eighth grade so he could go and do something that he loved. His dad thought that was also his best option to make a career, and Calvin is a very plain-spoken and hard-working guy, and you know, he won the Kentucky Derby two Saturdays ago, and the very next day he was out at his brother's barn at the crack of dawn exercising the cheap horses that he has because, as Calvin says, and he's not a very articulate guy, but he speaks from his heart, this is what got him there. And you know, shortly thereafter, he was meeting the Queen Mum at the White House with President Bush, and it's a big leap, and that's why a lot of people, I guess getting back to your original question, trying to wrap it up, they think that they might be able to latch on to that little bit of hope that is going to propel them into the horse racing stratosphere.
Well, that's what I figured, that partly, at least for the spectators and for the people who bet, partly of what it's so seductive is the idea that if you study the horses well enough, if you look at their records, if you know who the jockeys are, if you get some sense of what the conditions are and what horse runs best on what kind of track, and you know, try to figure out all those variables that can be ascertained and to sort of all mix them up there and run them through your gut, that somehow you can pick a winner. Well, now, I don't know if you really can, but I'm sure that people that's what they think.
Well, you're correct on both parts. People do think they can. I think the mistake that they make is that they think it's a lot easier than it really is. The professionals and the specialists that I know who, and there are very few of them, that are able to make a living as professional horse racing gamblers usually are very patient. They put in what to outsiders would seem like a ridiculous amount of work, studying and finding what their little niche is going to be and how they're going to exploit an advantage. And there are people who do make a living betting horse races, but it's a hard amount of work, and it doesn't come easy. And they aren't the type of people who are betting their brains out on every single race every day. They're usually specialists who pick their spots. However, to speak to your point about the greater allure of maybe being able to strike it rich is, you know, you can get into the betting of horses as a pastime, and you can maybe go out to the track for friends every now and then and enjoy it and set aside an amount that you budget that you're comfortable to lose in the afternoon. And if you lose that, fine, you know, and if you make some money, that's even better. It was a day of entertainment for you. It was an enjoyable afternoon. But then there are the people who take it to the next level, and they really do sort of get hooked on keeping their head in the statistics and constantly watching race replays and going through the racing form. And I think the one thing that differentiates horse racing from a lot of other forms of gambling is that, unlike when you step inside a casino, you're not playing against the house where the takeout structure, meaning the amount of money that's returned to the players who gamble, is pretty much set. When you play slot machines, they're usually set at a percentage in the high 90s, where 98 or 99% of the money is returned to players, and the casino makes a mint keeping that 1%. You wouldn't think so, but they really do. In horse racing, you're not playing against the house, so to speak. You're playing against everybody else. In horse racing, the way parimutuel betting works is the house, so to speak, the racetrack, serves almost like a stockbroker who facilitates a transaction. The players pool their money. The house, again, in this case the racetrack, holds the bets while the race is run. They ensure that everything is regulated properly and on the level. And then at the end of the race, the winning money is returned to the players in terms of the winning payouts. And the track only holds on to a certain amount, a certain slice, usually about the track's cut is 3%, but some money goes to the state and some money goes to fund other purses so the races can be run. But the track holds the money as the stakeholder, and you're really playing against everybody else, so you're not trying to leverage your gamble against the house, so to speak.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, T.D. Thornton, he is the author of the book Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. It's about a year out of the life of the racetrack Suffolk Downs, and it's published by Public Affairs, and it's about people and the horses and why it is that people love to go to the track and why they train them and ride them and the appeal of racing at this level of racing, which is certainly not the pinnacle, but I think he would argue if there weren't tracks like Suffolk Downs, maybe we wouldn't have the Kentucky Derby. And it's all kind of part of one system. The book's out just recently. You have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As I said, the Derby is one of those races that gets lots of attention, and people, if they only watch one horse race a year, that's probably the one that they watch. And one of the things that they, I'm sure, will note is that there's a lot of money involved here. The purse of the Kentucky Derby is $2 million. And I think the people maybe might be surprised by reading your story that one of the things that's really noteworthy is that if you win most on the average there at Suffolk Downs, if you win, the purse is really not very much, relatively speaking, is not very much money.
No, it's not. A horse at Suffolk Downs might run for a purse which is perhaps in the range of from $4,000 up to $25,000 for the better races. And it is, I'm not going to say that the higher profile horses don't deserve the larger purses, because I think if you're going to stage a sport with a lot of high profile events, you have to put up the money. It's like anything else in this world. However, what a lot of people might not realize is that the risks are essentially the same. A jockey who goes out to ply his trade stands, you know, I don't know the exact mathematics on this, I don't think anybody does, but stands an equal chance to get launched off his horse's back and break his neck in the Kentucky Derby as he does in a cheap $4,000 race at Suffolk Downs. And perhaps you could argue even that the cheaper races are even a little more dangerous because the horses aren't as sound. The horses, you know, just to give you an idea of the raw numbers and the statistics involved here, using a round number, there are 40,000 horses, thoroughbred racehorses, foaled in North America each year. And of that number, only about a third of them are ever going to get in and win an actual race. And when you break down the numbers even further, we saw 20 horses of that original foal crop of 40,000 step into the starting gate for the Kentucky Derby. Only one of them, Street Sense, can win it. And the other 39,999 horses have to fit in somewhere. And there are different plateaus all across the country. I know out your way in Illinois, you have a top-tier racetrack in Arlington Park, but you also have the smaller grind-along racetracks like Fairmount Park in Collinsville, Illinois, and Hawthorne Racecourse. And these are the minor leagues, so to speak, of horse racing. And the analogy that I like to make is it's almost like Major League Baseball. You couldn't have the World Series. You couldn't have your Red Sox-Yankees matchups. You couldn't go out to Wrigley Field and see the Cubs in all their splendor playing baseball if you didn't have all the minor league levels that set the game up and support the top structure. In horse racing, the minor league tracks serve as both the place where the horses who aren't good enough to compete at the top level of the game go to ply their trade, but they're also useful places for young trainers and young jockeys who are just starting out. You're not going to see young kids making their first rides in high-profile races like the Kentucky Derby. The one great equalizer about working on the backstretch of a thoroughbred racetrack is everybody, any jockey you've ever met, started the same way, shoveling a whole lot of horse manure and cleaning feed tubs and walking horses in endless circles to cool them out after they have their morning exercise. So when you say the minor leagues of racing, I don't say it in a disparaging way. It's almost like, you know, you might want to take the kids out to go to Wrigley Field, and if you can afford it and if you can get tickets. I know, like, here in Boston, it's difficult to go to Fenway Park to watch the Red Sox, but when you do, it's a heck of a lot of fun, and it's a great expenditure. But isn't it also fun to go to a minor league baseball game where you can get really up close to the action? If you went to the Kentucky Derby, for example, you wouldn't be able to get right up so close to the rail that you could touch the horses. At Suffolk Downs, for example, you could, and the jockeys are very good about coming up to the kids and giving them autographs and getting them involved in the game really up close, and you don't get that at the high-profile tracks. So the minor league tracks, even though I think horse racing itself, the industry sometimes shuns them or tries to sweep that aspect of the game under the rug in lieu of highlighting the high-profile races like the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness or the Breeders' Cup, it often disregards this aspect of the game, and I think that's wrong.
In round figures, what does it cost to operate a horse, a racehorse?
Well, you could. There are a lot of ways you could get entry into the game. You could go to one of the highfalutin auctions in Lexington, Kentucky, and purchase and sit next to multi-zillionaires who bid on horses on a whim in increments of hundreds of thousands of dollars. We just had a horse, a 2-year-old horse, very recently sell for a world record $16 million. The horse is yet to start. His name is the Green Monkey, and he has had a series of nagging injuries. So an expensive horse is prone to many of the liabilities and the just twists of fate that a cheap horse might. So you don't always get what you pay for in those high-profile auctions. You could maybe breed your own horse. You could maybe buy a horse privately. And you could probably gain entry in the game reasonably for anywhere from a few thousand dollars up to $10,000 or $20,000, and you would have some fun just going out to the races and being an owner. But you'd only have one horse, and it would be kind of like if you were treating it as an investment. You weren't very well diversified if your entire investment rides on one horse. And now once you get the horse, well, you're going to have to find a place to stable him. Racetracks across the country offer free stabling, but the catch is you have to have your horses ready to race and run at the particular track. And if you don't do that, stabling costs anywhere from $100 up to $1,000 per horse per month. And then you have to pay some people to take care of this horse. If you're assuming you're not a crackerjack horse trainer yourself, you're going to have to pay a trainer what they call a day rate, which is usually anywhere from $40 to $60 per horse. And then you tack in their feed. Maybe that's another few bucks a day, probably included in your day rate. Veterinary bills. Again, cheap horses and champions all get sick, and they're all prone to injuries. So the expenses can mount pretty fast. And if you're running for a little $4,000 purse at a racetrack like a Suffolk Downs or Hawthorne or a Fairmount Park, it's tough to break even. And so you can maybe gain entry in the game for as cheaply as you want or as expensive as you want. But if your horses aren't earning their oats, so to speak, you're very quickly going to find yourself swimming in bills.
Yeah, that's, I guess, my question is how many people actually, it just set aside the people who might make a lot of money on their horses, how many people can at least make enough money so that they can pay the bills and have enough left to have, you know, 10 or 20 bucks in their pocket afterwards?
Yeah, I would say I don't have an exact figure. I'd say it's slim. It's probably under 20%. And it's, you know, I'll back into this question by way of an example. My dad is a thoroughbred racehorse trainer. After when my dad has potential clients come up to him and ask him, geez, how can I get in the game? It's fun. I've come to the races for a long time. Horse racing is a little different than most sports because when you're a spectator, you can be a spectator who bets on the races, so you have a little more direct involvement than if you were sitting in the stands at a baseball game. But a spectator can also go out and buy the participants. You can't go out and buy the New York Yankees, at least not anybody that I know. So you can gain entry into the game. And what my dad will tell people very honestly is, don't do this if you're looking to make money. do this if you love horses, if you love coming out to the racetrack, if you want to take it up to the next level, if you want to be able to come out in the morning and bring your horse some carrots and be involved in the game and hobnob with jockeys and their agents and trainers and other owners, and if you want a nice box seating arrangement to sit in the day your horse races, you'll get all that, and you'll be able to bring people out to the track, and hopefully they will have a good time too. And what he tells people quite honestly is if we make a little money, that's going to be icing on the cake. So you have to treat it like that unless you are a person of ridiculous amounts of spare cash to spend.
I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about jockeys. Maybe you could talk about some that you have known and about that experience. And certainly, as you say, I think one of the things that maybe people don't appreciate is this is a very difficult job. It is very dangerous. It is certainly common to get hurt, and it's possible to get killed. These guys generally don't have health insurance. Life is really hard. Most of them probably don't make a whole lot of money. They put themselves and their bodies through all kinds of stuff to maintain the weight because they've got to be as light as possible. One could imagine that it would, on the one hand, be exciting, and on the other hand, would have an awful lot of downside.
It does. When you stack it up, David, like you just mentioned it there, it does have a tremendous amount of downsides, and almost a sane person would say, why would I want to put myself through this? But to take it back to the very first question you asked me, the jockeys do it because it's a pretty damn exhilarating sport, and it's also they're clinging to that one hope that they're going to get that, like a Calvin Burrell. They will come from the sticks in Louisiana to one day be dining with the president in the White House because they just won the Kentucky Derby. So they to break into the game as a jockey, as I mentioned earlier, you have to do a lot of menial work, and that kind of serves as a way to weed out the participants. If a 16-year-old kid shows up on the backstretch of Suffolk Downs and he says he wants to be a jockey, he's going to expect a good 6 months to a year of hard labor before they let him even gallop horses in the morning. Then when you do that, you have to go through an apprentice stage if you're a jockey and you actually ride in a race. And one thing about the jockeys is they're very good about teaching each other the tricks of the trade and what to do and what not to do, and that's mostly a safety concern, because if you're an experienced jockey, you don't want some reckless kid in the pack knocking you over the inner fence and breaking your neck. So the jockeys are very good about taking care of each other. It's very cutthroat. It's a very competitive environment, but yet at the same time they look out for each other, and that carries over to another plateau where, let's say, you're an apprentice and now you're good enough to become a journeyman jockey and you've proven you're worth your salt and you can stick it out in this profession. Now you've got to go out and establish a business. You've got to have some clients who ride you regularly, and it's a vicious cycle in that the top jockeys get the best mounts. And who are the best jockeys? Well, they're the ones who get the best mounts. So it's very cyclical. It's tough to break in, and I know a lot of jockeys who don't get a break to ride some of the better horses or some of the better clients or the better stables until somebody goes down in the line of action and then a spot opens up.
So they do jockeys essentially just get paid per ride? Are there jockeys that are kept on retainer by particular owners?
It used to be back in the day, it used to be a retainer system. It is now, you get a per-mount flat fee, somewhere probably, it's not a lot of money, $35 I think is the norm at a track like Suffolk Downs. That's just for getting out on the horse and getting him around the track. You also get a percentage. A jockey gets 10% of the winning purse. So, for example, the Kentucky Derby was a $2 million purse. That's divided amongst the first five finishers. So the winner gets $1.2 million. The winning owner gets $1.2 million. The jockey's going to get 10% of that. So Calvin Burrell essentially made $120,000 for his winning Kentucky Derby ride. And they do have a form of catastrophic injury insurance. It's put on by the Jockeys Union, which is called the Jockeys Guild. But the Jockeys Guild has been in trouble lately. Their finances have really come undone, so to speak. And there are jockeys that I know of out there who have suffered career-ending injuries, and they're paralyzed and they're in wheelchairs, and they're looking to pay the bills, and they don't have this insurance. And nor could they, if such a plan was available to them, the premiums would be almost so ridiculously high that it would be prohibitive for the smaller jockeys on the totem pole to take out their own catastrophic injury insurance. the way the guild, if I'm correct in this, funds the insurance is something that you see in horse racing that you don't see in a lot of other sports. When the guild was formed back in the 1940s, there was a lot of resistance across the country to the jockeys forming some kind of union. To this day, it's a voluntary union. Not every jockey that rides has to be in it. But they decided way back when in the 1940s that the jockeys at least had the presence of mind to know that nobody else is going to pay for our injuries. So the guys who rise to the top of the profession, who are the cream of the crop in terms of what they earn for a living, they're going to give a bigger cut in their dues to take care of the little guys. And that's kind of the way it's always been in the sport of horse racing. There is a lot of generosity that a lot of people don't hear of. I know, for example, when jockeys that I know of have become hurt or disabled, they pass the hat, literally, in the jockey's room, and everybody throws in what they can. And if you were to look very closely, the guys who contribute the most are usually the ones who can least afford it. And the guys who are really at the top of the game are pretty generous about unloading with the wallet and helping out.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest, T.D. Thornton, he's the author of the book, Not By a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track, that track being Suffolk Downs. The book is published by Public Affairs. It is a story of a year in the life of this track. I think it was 2000. He catalogs what happened at the racetrack over that time. And it's about horse racing and really what life is like in what I think he would say, it was correct to say, it's like the minor leagues of horse racing. But all sports have to have them. It is a way of training jockeys and finding, you know, separating the so-so horses from the great horses. He has written for several papers, most notably the Boston Globe and also the National Thoroughbred Daily Racing Times. And he's with us here by telephone. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller over in the nearby community of Belgium. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I was listening to you talking about the wagering involved with this, and I don't know if you may very well have heard this story, but I heard a recounting that recently, I think even when it was the last Kentucky Derby, somebody bought every possibility for the, was it trifecta, perfecta, whatever the one where they had different combinations, and the price for it was like $13,000. And he was guaranteed to win, obviously, since he bought every combination. But his payback for the combination he won on was only like $400 or $500. So he obviously lost $13,000, even though he won.
Yeah, that I have heard that happen. And those aren't really gamblers who are making those plays. That's not an informed play. I would not suggest to anybody, even if you had that amount of disposable cash, that you played what is called an all trifecta combination, or even the superfecta, which is a more risk but also a greater reward of picking the first four horses in order. And a trifecta would be getting the first three horses in order. Somebody did that on a lark, and I'm sure there were a lot of somebodies who tried that. Let's put it this way: if you did it this year, you lost money. Your numbers are pretty correct. You lost about $13,000 or $14,000 because Street Sense was the favorite. When the favorites win, the prices are lower. Now, if you had that cash burning a hole through your wallet and you did that when Giacomo won the Kentucky Derby 2 years ago, well, Giacomo was well over 50-1, and the superfecta payout for a $1 ticket on the exact order of finish for the first four horses paid $850,000. So you were getting a return on your investment of $850,000 to 1. It's not something I would suggest that anybody does, but people do it. People have this amount of money that I wouldn't have to do that, and it's not an informed play. It's like going up to a lottery terminal and saying, give me as many Powerball numbers as I can afford, and hopefully you strike it rich.
Yeah, exactly. The very few times that I've gone to a racing parlor, it just didn't. You put down $2 and you get back $2.30. Wait a minute, I thought I bet $2. You know, you just scratch your head. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks. Well, I guess that gets into the somewhat arcane territory of odds and how that determines the payback. I guess, roughly speaking, I think about it as being, I guess if a horse is 5-1, the odds are 5-1 to win, that means that if you bet $1 and the horse wins, you get 5. Is that right?
Yes, and you'd get your original dollar back, so you're
you get six dollars. But I guess that again is part of the seductive business. If you find a horse that's a real long shot, meaning the odds are long, that could be 10 to 1, could be more. If that horse happens to win, the payback is pretty good. But it's just that it doesn't happen that often.
Well, to answer your question with a quick explanation, horse racing gambling is a type of gambling called paramutual wagering, which is used to be called Paris mutuals, but it's a French term meaning betting among ourselves. So as we said earlier, you're not betting against the house. If there are 10,000 of us at the racetrack, we're all playing against each other's money, and we're all trying to outfox each other. Mm-hmm. And what happens is when all the money gets centrally pooled, let's say that there's one horse, we'll use the Kentucky Derby as an example because it's fresh in people's minds. Street Sense looked like one of the dominant horses on paper. All of his racing statistics and everything you read in the press suggested he was one of the likeliest horses to win the race. So a lot of people bet money on him, thus his odds came down. When a lot of people fancy a certain horse, just when they put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, his chances of winning are higher, but your return on investment is going to be a little bit lower. Now, for example, there's a horse like Giacomo who won the Kentucky Derby 2 years ago. Nobody in there, if you had given me the list of 20 horses that year in the Derby and ranked them, who would be most likely to win, Giacomo would have been down near 18 or 19 or 20 on my list. Nobody regarded him as having a good chance. Thus, there wasn't a lot of influx of cash on him to bet with. And when he did score the upset of the decade, the people who did put their $2 on him were rewarded with a huge windfall because he had it's a risk versus reward equation. It was a very risky proposition to say a horse like Giacomo was going to win, but if he does win, you're going to get a big bang for your buck.
Well, you talked about the fact that the odds can be influenced by the betting, that is, the number of people who bet on a particular horse to win can change the odds. Does someone at the beginning sit down and look at all the horses and figure out some sort of initial determination, or is that all sort of up to what it is the collective consciousness of the people at the track that day say about who they think is going to win?
Yes, there is a starting point. It's called the morning line, and when you open your racetrack program, if you go to the track, it will say next to a horse's name, for example, Street Sense, 4 to 1. And the person who is a racetrack employee whose job it is not to say who he thinks is going to win the race, but who he thinks the betting public will fancy in the race. That's the starting off point. Once the bell goes off and they open the windows for wagering, it is determined by the amount of cash that comes in. And again, getting back to something we talked about earlier, the professional horse players, the people who are halfway good at the game, they don't make money so much by picking winners, but they can pick the discrepancies in the betting. They can say, boy, the betting public really is all over such and such a horse, Curlin in the Derby, in the Kentucky Derby, for example, who just ran third. I think he's kind of vulnerable. I like this horse at 10 to 1, who really should be 5 or 6 to 1, but the betting public is not assessing him correctly. So I think I have a bargain here, and the professional bettors will capitalize not so much on the way the horse's statistics are, but the way that the betting public perceives those statistics.
Hmm. I think that casinos, I think they're not real high on professional gamblers. Do the tracks think that people like that are okay? Do they have any problem with them?
You know, a casino will kick you out.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, if you're too successful, they'll say, get out of here.
Yeah, and they can. They're a privately run business, and they have authority from the Gambling Commission in their respective states to bar anybody that they think is getting an unfair advantage over the house. And again, that comes back to the point where in a casino, you're betting against the house. Somebody is making a determination that we could be vulnerable for a risk of losing some money here. We're going to ask this gentleman to leave the blackjack table. In horse racing, because you're not playing against the house, everyone is welcome. You, if you're a big bettor, if you're a small bettor, if you think you know more than the next guy, your money is always going to be welcome because the racetrack doesn't care, and nor should they, because they're only, again, take their profit is extruded from a small percentage for processing the wagers. You're not going to beat the house. You're going to beat the other people.
I talked about the fact that the structure of the book essentially is a year at Suffolk Downs, and so it's in part about the mechanics of racing and who does it and what happens. But partly it's also a history of Suffolk Downs that, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, was at one point one of the finest tracks in the country. This would be back in the mid-30s when it opened up. What was Suffolk Downs like in its glory day?
Suffolk Downs is very emblematic of a lot of racetracks across the country, some of them that have since fallen by the wayside and are shuttered. But Suffolk Downs in the 1930s and 40s, just to set the scene, and again, this almost goes for any track in the country, it was the place to see and be seen. It was the big sporting event of the day back then, even eclipsing Major League Baseball, which was huge. If you were in Boston in the 1930s or 40s and you were to go on the subway to go buy a newspaper, they hawked the newspapers based not on the strength of breaking news, but by how updated the race results were on the back page. They put out editions throughout the afternoon based on what race results were available to the general public. Everybody went to the racetrack. You look at pictures from Suffolk Downs from the 1930s and 40s, and the grandstand is just filled end to end. Everybody got dressed up. Either it was fedoras or stylish ladies' hats or servicemen's caps. And jockeys were treated like star athletes. They even had groupies following them around. They went to nightclubs in Boston, and people were buying them drinks and buying them free meals. And the racing itself rivaled anywhere in the country. The racing at Suffolk Downs matched the quality of racing. And what happened at Suffolk Downs happened at a lot of tracks across America in the late 1940s and early 50s. They were the only game in town. It was not only just the only place you could place a bet, but it was one of the only sporting venues in a lot of towns, and it was an entertainment outlet too. And when the hot new technology in the early 1950s was something called television, the powers that be at the major networks went to the powers that be in the sport of horse racing and said, "We'd like to have your races on TV in a big way." And here's where horse racing tripped up, and it's cost them ever since. Horse racing said no. And their reasoning was that having the races on TV would usurp fans from the stands. People would stop coming. And the networks repeatedly said, geez, you know, outside of maybe the major events like the Kentucky Derby, they wanted racing on TV every day on every major network, and racing kept turning them down. So eventually, if they were rebuffed long enough, the networks were going to go away, and they went to Major League Baseball, and they went to the fledgling National Football League and the fledgling National Basketball League and said, would you like to be on television? And those sports leapt at the chance. They jumped to be on board to a wider audience. And look what it's done now. Now, fast forward 50 years from there, a huge percentage of American males stay home every Sunday in the autumn because they can't get away from the TV. They have to watch their football games. NBA basketball, Major League Baseball is so huge. ESPN, the growth and the explosion of televised sports has been huge, and racing has had to play catch-up ever since then. And now when you watch a racing broadcast on TV, chances are pretty good, unless it's one of the three major Triple Crown events, racing pays for all of those other broadcasts. They have to buy that airtime to be on there. And they dug themselves a hole that they never got out of. Now when you compound that and you say, well, what happened in the 1960s, there were other forms of gambling. State lotteries became legal. So now the states were not only the regulators of horse racing, but they were also its competitor, which is a very unusual situation. In the 1980s and the 1990s, casino gambling exploded across the country, and now the gambling landscape was changed. You didn't have to go to a Suffolk Downs to get a bet down. Now in the 1990s, the Internet and the Internet poker boom came along, and now you don't even have to leave your house to gamble, and there were so many other entertainment and gambling options that horse racing just, it was too much of a good thing for a while, and when it thought it was the only game in town that was invincible, that was its downfall.
Yeah. Well, I think that too, as you say, that for people who want to gamble, there are now a lot of opportunities to do that. There, as you say, there are state lotteries, and there are casinos on land, and there are casinos on water, what strikes me that the gaming, as I like to call themselves, the gaming industry has tried to, and perhaps with some success, promoted casino gambling as just good, clean fun. I mean, the state lotteries have done the same, and that somehow I think that the track still has, there's something still sort of unsavory about the track. There's some sort of seediness that I think in a lot of people's minds has attached itself to the idea of the racetrack. Now, I think that that's probably unfair, but that, that somehow racing hasn't managed to promote itself very well.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that point. It's there is a certain amount of seediness. If you're a degenerate like me, you kind of like a little bit of that seediness there because it gives it a little bit of an edge. But horse racing is a very intimidating sport to get interested in. Unless somebody brings you to the track and kind of helps you along for a day at the races and explains all the wonderful mysteries that go into trying to pick winners and some of the wonderful tradition-rich rituals that go on at the racetrack, they can be tough to understand. It's very difficult to open up a racing program and see for the average Joe to see those that pages of statistics and reams of numbers that don't make any sense. And you know, some of the bets are so arcane and so complicated that, you know, unless you have somebody who really knows what they're doing to explain it to you, it's a tough place for a beginner to walk in and feel that they have an edge or feel that they know what they're doing or feel at least that they're not getting hoodwinked by somebody who does know what they're doing. And that's different at a casino. You go to a casino, and you're greeted at the door by professional greeters who ask if you're a newcomer, and they steer you to a newcomer's area, and they ply you with some free food and some free drinks, and even just a nice smile and a pleasant attitude, which is unfortunately absent from a lot of racetracks. And you feel a little more comfortable. And let's face it, as much of a big horse racing degenerate fan I am, I have the opposite view of casinos. You really couldn't pay me to step foot in one of them. There's nothing there that is an allure to me. There's nothing that grabs me. Plus, I think that they've contributed to the killing off of horse racing to a certain degree, so I won't give them my money. But, you know, there is something to be said on a very simplistic level. It doesn't take much to learn how to play a slot machine, and the learning curve in horse racing is a lot steeper. It's a lot more intimidating, and I think that does kind of prohibit or inhibit people from coming out to the track.
Our guest in this hour focus, T.D. Thornton. He's written for the Boston Globe and for the National Thoroughbred Daily Racing Times and other literary journals as well, often comments on racing on television and radio. He is the author of the recently published book, Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Racetrack. It's published by Basic Books. It's about a year in the life of Suffolk Downs, and it's about horse racing and the appeal of horse racing and who the people are who do it and why. It's a very interesting book. You might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you mentioned, what has happened here as there's been the growth of casino gambling in a lot of places, that now the casino gambling and those interests are competing with whatever racetracks, whatever racing industry there is left. And here in this state, and I'm sure in other states, people who are associated with racing, and I'm sure that in many cases it's the people who own the tracks, the people who have the greatest to lose, the most to lose, talk about make appeals to the state government to do something to try to preserve the racing industry. And they seem to frame that in terms of jobs. Job preservation. And whenever I hear those arguments, I guess the first thing I wonder is, well, now really, how many people can there be, say, in the state of Illinois or the state of Massachusetts or any other state? How many people can there be whose livelihood depends on horse racing?
Well, I'll give you a basic breakdown here, and that it's you have to think of it in terms of beyond the people who actually touch horses and are hands-on with horses. Using my track as an example, that I'm familiar with, Suffolk Downs, there are about 1,200 horses on the grounds, and the general rule of thumb is one person for each horse. That might be a trainer, it might be a groom, it might be a basic laborer back there, but it's almost a one-to-one ratio. The racetrack itself at Suffolk Downs probably employs about 500 people, anywhere from food service workers, from the people behind the betting windows who take the wagers, to security, to people who do maintenance and upkeep. And then, of course, there are the jockeys and the trainers and the people who own horses. But then I think for a lot of people the human aspect of it and the jobs aspect of it stops there. But then you have to think, for example, of at Suffolk Downs, there's all these little convenience stores and liquor stores and food marts and supermarkets that are around the racetrack. There's also a couple of hotels in the area that draw in the casual tourist type of race players. There's also the people who own apartments and rent apartments and condos. So if there are that large amount of people working at the track or nearby, they've got to have a place to live. So that's part of the racing economy that props up as well. And then the circle goes even wider. There are restaurants and other types of retail who depend on, you know, a steady stream of 10,000 cars coming in and out of the Suffolk Downs parking lot every weekend. And it goes even beyond that. It's, here in Massachusetts, all these horses have to eat some hay. And if you drive out into the western part of the state here in Massachusetts, you see all these beautiful hay fields that, if there wasn't a racetrack buying ridiculous amounts of grain and feed, those would be shopping malls. So there, it's an open space issue as well. So when you're driving along the highway and you see somebody who's devoted their land to growing grain for horse consumption, I mean, they're going to be out of business if there's no racetrack either. And there's also the horse breeding operation, those beautiful horse farms that you see all down. A lot of them in this country are centralized in Kentucky, but there are some in every state. And I know Illinois has a very good in-state breeding program with some incentives to race and raise horses in the state. So it's kind of like the ripple effect. You can throw the stone in the water, and the ripples are going to keep on going outward even farther than you would imagine at first blush.
Mm. We have just a couple of minutes left. I think when you recently were talking about the book and racing with Bill Littlefield on Only a Game, you said something like one of the things that people always ask, I want to make sure I ask, one of the things people always ask about racing is it on the level?
Yes, this is that's undoubtedly the first question that the newcomers will ask me on a day to the races, and my answer is, for the most part, racing is a pretty honest sport. It's I like to say it's like ivory soap. It's like 99.44% pure. But the other flip side of that is, in my opinion, if that 0.56% of larceny didn't exist, it wouldn't be any fun. And horse racing has never had a shortage of colorful characters, many of whom are portrayed, and not by a long shot, that, let's face it, they're hustlers, they're grinders. They would rather do the same amount of work to steal 50 cents than it would be the same amount of work to earn an honest buck. There are people like that. There are some colorful people. They're certainly not in the majority, but they do exist, and they add a little bit of flavor to the game.
And horses, like human athletes, are tested for the presence of performance-enhancing substances?
They are. Racing is a little bit, I think you can say almost any professional sport is a little bit behind these days, because this whole performance-enhancing drug thing has really just exploded over the past 5 or 10 years. And horse racing is not immune from that. It's no different. For example, it's left up to the jurisdiction of the state in which the horses are racing. And they test for certain drugs, for example, like EPO or Epogen. But they don't, for example, anabolic steroids are totally unregulated in horse racing, which is ridiculous. The other thing that people should be aware of is that there are performance-enhancing drugs, but there are also some people out there who want to make a buck by slowing down certain favorites, because if you're going to fix a horse race, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to speed a horse up so he can race his eyeballs out. It might mean that you want to depress or slow down one of the heavily bet favorites so you can cash a ticket on some of the other longer-priced horses in the race. It doesn't happen with the frequency that it used to back in the good old days of the sport, that the scammers would at least call them the good old days. There is a lot more scrutiny. There is a lot more. There are a lot more checks and balances. But it's like almost any other endeavor. I think if you ask the people that are involved in horse racing, they would say there isn't a lot of cheating going on. If you ask the general public, they would say it's rife with cheating. The real answer lies somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. I'm trying to squeeze real quick somebody in here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. First, I'd like to thank you for the topic. My understanding of the horse population in Illinois is that we actually have more horses here than they do in Kentucky. The horse racing, not just the horse racing industry, but the whole horse industry in Illinois is kind of a well-kept secret. So I would like to thank WILL for having a program on horses and say I really enjoyed the program. Could you make a comment on the small racetracks of the efficacy of harness racing versus flat racing?
Harness racing is for the general listener out there who might not be familiar, thoroughbred racing is the racing with the jockey directly on the horse's back in a saddle. The standard bred or harness racing is when they pull the cart, often called a bike, which is, does not resemble a bicycle, resembles more of a chariot, behind the horses, and there is a, it was called a driver instead of a jockey. They are similar in that they both involve a horse, but they're two very different worlds. I don't know a lot of people who professionally cross over between one or the other. I myself will go out and enjoy a night at the harness track on occasion, but it's not something that I specialize in. And again, there's not a heck of a lot of crossover.
Well, just as a way of finishing it in about a minute or less, the question, will the smaller tracks, will the Suffolk Downs of the country manage to survive?
I think they will. And here's my one big point, if I could end on this. You know, people say with a broad brush all across the country, you hear that horse racing is dying. And that's not true. Horse racing is changing, and the tracks who refuse to change will die off. I'm very certain about that. That's a strong bet. There are a lot of horse racing is rooted in tradition. Some of those traditions are welcome, and they're part of the great allure of the sport. But tradition to some people means being a stick in the mud and not changing your ways. And the game has really changed. The industry has changed now. There are $15 billion bet on horse thoroughbred races in this country every year. That's been constant for the past few years. The pie hasn't changed, but the way that the pie is sliced up is changing. And, for example, it's no longer as pertinent to get people to come out for a day at the races as it is to bring the mountain to the masses. You can wager in-home now. There's all sorts of technological advances where there's global wagering from around the country that you can do either via your internet connection or your television set-top box. And I think that if racing doesn't embrace some of these changes and doesn't get a little more comfortable with the fact that the days of 40,000 people coming out to Suffolk Downs on a weekday, it just ain't going to happen anymore. And if the sport wants to survive, it has to find a way to reach the diehard and the degenerates like me who really love the game and really want to be involved in it. It's going to have to change, and there are going to have to be some advances, and there are going to have to be maybe a shaking out of the industry where some of the smaller tracks that aren't pulling their weight and they aren't contributing to the overall good of the game, they might have to fall by the wayside before the game gets better.
That's where we got to leave it. The book is Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track, published by Public Affairs by our guest T.D. Thornton. Mr. Thornton, thanks very much.
Great talking to you, David. Thank you for having me.